Do you know what time it is? It's supernatural story time. And if you're easily scared, and even if you're not, there's only one thing left to do. Just turn off the lights, because these are stories that you listen to only in the dark. No Place Like the Morgue, Volume 2, Story 1. Back when I was in college, the student campus council hired a famous ghost hunter to come speak at our school. I've always loved the paranormal, so I left my skeptical boyfriend behind in his dorm and hightailed it over to the auditorium. The ghost hunter was someone I'd never heard of, but he had an impressive background and seemed to have several things in the works at the time. This was in 2005. I think he actually might have a TV show now. He was a man of small stature, with a little white professor's beard and a receding hairline. But the way he spoke about the afterlife was fascinating. You could tell he truly believed what he claimed to see. Either that, or he was a hell of a salesman. He had us hanging on every word. We watched some interesting video clips of his investigations. He had a nice collection of photos and scary stories to go with him. I remember one about a haunted doll that he said moved freely around the room of the person who had picked it up at a flea market, just not when anyone was around to witness it, though. Towards the end, he opened up the floor for questions. They were your typical dumbass college kid questions. Have you ever seen someone's head spin around like The Exorcist? Stuff like that. And a few that were actually pretty interesting. I decided I wasn't going to let this opportunity to speak to someone as apparently revered in the field of the supernatural slip away, so I raised my hand. The ghost hunter spotted me, pointed and smiled. Yes, you, the girl in the white shirt. Yeah, hi, I said, and I know I sounded nervous because I felt so dumb for sounding so nervous. I was just wondering, what's the scariest thing you can remember from your career as a ghost hunter? I was halfway back in the auditorium, quite a distance from the stage, but I saw his face fell. I know it did. Well, he said, forcing a tight little laugh. It was forced. I know it was. There are so many scary moments to recall. They tend to pop up quite often when you're in my line of work. This got a little chuckle from the audience. I suddenly felt pretty stupid for asking the question at all. He proceeded to tell some story about tracking a poltergeist in an abandoned elementary school and his flashlight failing. I remember because it really wasn't very scary. At least, it didn't seem that way for someone who hunts ghosts for a living. He moved on from the story and answered a few more questions. He didn't look my way again. When it was over and everyone started to leave, I decided not to get stuck in the crush of students leaving through the front door. Feeling somewhat dejected, like I had done something wrong, I slipped quietly out the theater exit and headed for my dorm. The ghost hunter was sitting outside on a bench near the bike rack, smoking a cigarette. I ducked my head and tried to get by without him noticing. Hey, kid! He took another drag and crushed a cigarette out on the cement bench beside him. Listen, I'm sorry. I remember blurting, feeling like such a stupid little girl. I know my question was dumb. I wasn't trying to make fun of you or anything. He shook his head. He brushed the ashes off the bench. He patted the space beside him, inviting me to sit. I hesitated. This could definitely be a case of stranger danger, but just like they taught in the intro to university classes, then sat down, keeping a healthy distance between us. He was old, I was young. I could probably outrun the guy. Or who knows, maybe I was just as stupid as I felt. I didn't tell the truth, the ghost hunter said. His face looked much older close up. The wrinkles deeper, the confident salesman aura had faded from him, leaving behind a man in his 60s who had clearly seen a lot of things. That story I told, it wasn't the scariest moment of my career. I know, I remember saying, he nodded, as though he had known I knew. This is the scariest moment of my career, he said, and this is what he told me. It was the 1970s. I was a much younger man. I hadn't reached success in the paranormal industry quite yet and was left to pick up the scraps that the pros didn't want. Usually they were schizophrenics whose broken minds tricked them into believing there was phantoms after them, or children playing pranks on gullible and concerned members of the neighborhood. If anything, it was a simple cleansing of the home with sage, and off I went. When I first got the call, I was ecstatic. What the client was describing appeared to be a full-blown demonic haunting, complete with physical manifestations, possession, and multiple witnesses. It was the break I was searching for. It was the break I needed. The only detail that truly worried me was that their teenage son, the person they claimed to be suffering from possession, had become violent with members of his family. Up until recently, he had only acted out of character, moody. However, a week prior, he had tried to rape his older female cousin. She was shaken, but mostly unharmed. The family sent her to live elsewhere until it could all be figured out. Therefore, when I headed out to their home, I made sure to arrive fully prepared. I brought holy water, crucifixes, sage, and, just for good measure, a small loaded handgun. I knew it wouldn't come to that, but something about the mother's frantic tone over the phone told me it was just a good idea. I wish I could say the visit itself was exciting. Unfortunately, from the moment I pulled into the driveway of the beautiful remodeled Victorian, all activity seemed to stop. That is, if it was ever there to begin with. I spent 2 weeks investigating the home. I used equipment considered very technologically advanced for the era. I studied energy waves. I interviewed the son whose family claimed to be possessed, when in fact he just seemed to be depressed, perhaps psychologically disturbed. I recommended a therapist, a renowned child psychologist who was famous for his work with violent young men. On my last day in the house, they took him into the city for treatment. His parents returned shortly before midnight, retiring wearily to the bedroom, leaving me alone in the kitchen to go over my findings. There was nothing to be said, and I knew it. Everything they described could be written off to the hysterics of a family who couldn't admit their son was in desperate need of medical attention. Everything, that is, except for the drains in the floor. Upon touring the home, I was impressed with how up-to-date it had been brought. It was clearly from the early 1900s and kept in immaculate condition. The woodwork and character of the house was carefully preserved as it was given necessary updates, like modern plumbing and electricity. The basement was the only area that seemed stuck in time. The walls were clammy stone that were prone to gathering moisture, leaving it unfit to store anything vulnerable to spiders or mold. The family had left it empty for this reason, and while it certainly felt very spooky to spend any amount of time in the windowless room with a single hanging light in its vast cement floors, I never record anything of note in this area. However, there was one thing I couldn't understand. Given the approximate time the home had been built and its presence in a residential neighborhood, there was simply no accounting for the four large slotted drains set in the cold concrete floor. As I sat alone in the kitchen, poring over my meager findings, trying to find meaning in all these words, I heard something. It was only a little sound at first, so I ignored it, but then it came again, louder this time. There was a steep spiral staircase that led to the second floor, winding up from the corner of the small kitchen, and it was where the noise seemed to be coming from. Assuming it was simply one of the homeowners restless after dropping their son off in an institution, I glanced up. It was coming down the stairs. I can't say walking because that wasn't the case. It was just floating, isn't even the right word, just coming down the stairs straight at me. It had no eyes. It had no face. And yet somehow I knew it was looking at me, right at me, into the very depths of my soul. Then it spoke. I'm not sure how it spoke. I don't think I actually heard anything. So perhaps it used some sort of telepathy. Either way, I can recall the words to this very day. You know what he did to us. I didn't think, I couldn't, I just ran. I upended my chair when I fled, scattering papers across the kitchen that claimed this house wasn't really haunted. It was all the hallucinations of a very sick boy. I left them there. Do you know how awful that is? I left those people in that house with that thing. I didn't stop driving for 30 miles, for God's sake. When I realized how far I'd gone, I'd finally pulled over and called a family from a payphone. They were the furthest thing from my mind when I saw it. All I could do was respond to the deep animal instinct to escape, to run out of the supposedly safe house with my tail between my legs. They moved, I think. I was unable to continue my investigation. In writing, I cited insufficient evidence, but I knew it was cowardice. I believe the house was leveled a few years later. I ended up doing my own research. Curiosity ate away at me with vicious little rat teeth as time went by, the accusations still ringing fresh in my ears. You know what he did to us. And eventually, yes, I did. Old newspaper clippings didn't tie the stories together. Not necessarily, but I was able to piece some meaning out of the yellowed excerpts. At some point around the turn of the century, the house had been residence to a well-respected mortician. Unable to find a building in town to suit his needs, he said he built his own home as well as office space. It was a grand feat of architecture and a shining example of true entrepreneur, a man pursuing the American dream of running his own business. Upstairs, the bedroom. Mid-level, the funeral home. In the basement, a mortuary. I knew what the drains were for. Separately, decades later, another well-respected member of the local community was arrested under the suspicion of abuse of his professional position with moral cause. The newspaper didn't elaborate, probably due to the sensitive nature of the crimes, but his punishment was minor. After a brief stay in the local jail, the perpetrator stripped his home of all its value and left town before trial, never to be seen again. It didn't take much to guess the connection. I suppose, I don't know for sure, but the words of that thing still echo through my head to this day. You know what he did to us. There was a reason that mortician felt such a strong desire to build a house that contained his business to suit his needs. The things that were done to those bodies in the basement was unspeakable. But yes, I know. I know what he did to them. And it's because of this. Coming face to face with the true nature of man in its darkest places, that the encounter with that faceless thing is the scariest moment of my career. Because now I know. I still remember his expression, the way all the color dropped out of him as he went on, the white hair of his beard barely distinguishable from his pale skin, the slump of his shoulders, the way his voice shook. I apologized. He waved me off. He left. I felt terrible. I still feel terrible for making him relive the moment. But as I grew up, as campus activities were replaced with bills and my own career, the ghost hunter fell from the forefront of my mind little by little. Until last week, when I moved in with my fiancé, when I took the boxes into the basement despite his warnings of spiders and mold, because there's a large slotted drain in the center of the room. And I'm so worried, so scared about what I might know. Story number two. When I graduated from Maranello with a diploma in beauty, culture, and cosmetology, I had all kinds of ideas about what I would do with it. First week out of school, I sent my CV and resume off to all the major fashion publications. That was a job of my dreams, you know? Putting makeup on models and celebrities before their front cover photo shoots. Then, after a hard day of work, cocktail parties. One can dream, right? But when 2 months went by and I didn't get a single call back, I resorted to looking at less ideal jobs. Jobs like working at the makeup booths in Neiman Marcus or Saks Fifth, or even Macy's. I'd take it. Finally, 3 weeks and 7 failed interviews later, reality hit me hard. Beauty, culture, and cosmetology is a worthless diploma. To help with the bills, I took a temp gig working at a costume shop, putting makeup on kids who wanted to look like zombies for a day. I quit on the third day after some ADHD kid bit me in the neck because he was convinced he had become a real vampire. My student loans dried up not long after that. I was behind on the rent, the phone bill, the credit card bill. My life was in shambles. I realized that if I didn't want to move back to Fresno with my mom and my stepdad, I'd have to be less picky with my profession. And that's how I wound up working here, at the Jefferson Funeral Home, as a mortuary cosmetologist. I styled dead people. From what I understand, most morticians are trained in cosmetology, and funeral homes generally do not employ a full-time makeup artist. But this is Hollywood we're talking about, People want to look good even when they're dead. I'll never forget the first time I worked with a dead body. Her cheeks were stiff and her lips were black like the shell of a chestnut. The pockets around her eyes were deep and hollow. While I was applying makeup on her face, I unintentionally rested one hand on her chest. And nobody warned me about this thing called the purge. When I pressed a little too hard, red-brownish purge fluids began oozing from her eyes, mouth, and nose. It was a truly horrendous sight. Had the funeral director not been there supervising me, I might have broken down in tears. Looking back, my temp job at the costume shop really wasn't all that different from this. Only instead of making people who are alive look like they're dead, I'm doing the opposite. What's there to be afraid of anyway? They look so calm, so at peace. It's almost the same as working with mannequins. Bottom line is, I'd much rather work with dead people than deal with hyperactive children. By the end of my fifth day as a dead person maker-upper, I've seen more dead bodies than some people will in their entire lifetime. It was only a matter of time before I'd become desensitized to the idea. Or so I thought. It was on my sixth day of working at the Jefferson Funeral Home that the truly frightening side of the job began to manifest. As usual, Howard wheeled the gurney into the prep room where I do my work. He was the embalmer as well as the assistant funeral director. The client was a young woman in her early 20s who died from a drug overdose a few days prior. Her family provided us with her grad photo from high school, in which she donned a long sapphire blue dress and a tiara with glittering Swarovski crystals. "Wow, what happened to her?" I remarked, just as Howard was about to leave. "I told you, drug overdose." "No, I mean what happened. Look at the photo. It's not even the same person." This girl must have gained at least 30 pounds since her grad photo, 15 of which could be attributed to her gargantuan breast implants. "Don't be disrespectful. They can hear you." Howard gave me a one-eye wink and shut the door behind him. Alone in the room, I turned my attention to the client. I pinched my nostrils shut as soon as I noticed the smell emanating from her corpse. She reeked. The combination of baby powder and embalming fluids make for a very unpleasant odor. But that wasn't it. There was another smell lingering in the air. And though it was mild in comparison to the odor of the embalming agents, this smell was far more nauseating. Stomaching the urge to barf, I styled her hair in likeness of her high school grad photo. Bleach blonde strands fell to the floor as I ran a comb through the hair, coarse and full of knots. If she was alive, she'd probably ask me to be gentler. When I was satisfied with the resemblance to the photo, I placed the tiara onto her head and began working on her face. Looking back and forth between the body and the photograph, I noticed for the first time something unnatural about her facial expression. Her eyes seemed to droop to the right, and her mouth was locked in a half-open frown. Was she trying to tell me something? Despite my best efforts, I couldn't make her look like the girl in the picture. I'm a makeup artist, not a magician. It was getting really late, so whatever I'd done would have to do. I don't get paid on the clock anyway. After getting cleaned up, I packed my things and left the building. The nearest bus stop was 5 blocks away. No time to waste. I waved goodbye to Howard when I saw him looking at me from his office window on the second floor. He waved back. I was almost certain he was checking me out. It wasn't until I was 3 steps from home that I realized I'd left my purse in the prep room by the sink, along with my house keys and everything else in it. Even my cell phone was in there. Fuck my life. An hour later, I found myself back at the funeral home. The front door wasn't locked, but the receptionist had already gone home. I looked around to see if anybody was still working, and when I couldn't find anyone, I went straight to the prep room. Click. The door was locked. It's not unusual for the room to be locked at this hour, so I didn't think too much of it. I figured I'd call Howard using the phone at the front desk since he alone had the key while the funeral director was away. But as I turned to leave, I heard some strange sounds. Sounds coming from within the prep room. Eek, eek, eek. My hair stood on end. It was the sound of the gurney being wheeled around. Eek, eek, eek. Leaning against the door, I lowered myself and peered through the keyhole. I saw a man with his pants down, fucking the dead body of the girl I was putting makeup on earlier in the evening. Just when I was about to scream, someone grabbed me from behind and covered my mouth with his hand. I was dragged away from the door and up the staircase into the director's office, where my captor threw me into a sofa. I turned around and saw a tall, scary-looking Hispanic man who was dressed like a nightclub bouncer. Standing next to him was Howard. It finally dawned on me just exactly what was going on. Howard, how could you? Shh, he put a finger over his lip. I buried myself into the corner of the couch as he sat down next to me. Okay, I know you're startled, but trust me, this kind of thing is the norm at every funeral home in LA. It's not that big of a deal. Not that big of a deal? You're pimping out dead bodies? Then the tall man suddenly locked the door behind him and took off his blazer. When he approached me, Howard pleaded, just give me 1 minute, please. She's new. I'll talk to her. It won't be a problem, I promise. Turning back to face me, said, okay, listen. The gentleman downstairs is a very influential man in Hollywood. If you don't keep your mouth shut, it's going to be your dead body on that stretcher next. You understand that? I nodded and didn't say a thing. At this point, I was scared for my life. Stay here. Howard got up and ushered away the tall man, who shot me an intimidating glare just as he left. On his way out, Howard locked the door from the outside. While they were away, I looked around the director's office and saw a photograph hanging on the wall. It was a frontal shot of the Jefferson Funeral Home, with the director and the rest of the staff standing in the front lawn. Standing among them was a chubby girl with bleach blonde hair, Stacy, the mortuary cosmetologist I was hired to replace after she died from a drug overdose. Story number 3. A week ago, before I began hearing the knocking, I was walking along the beach, watching the waves break across the sand and sweep back into the surf. The day was sunny, and a pleasant breeze kept me from sweating. I'd been staying at a nearby hostel as I was traveling up the coast on one of those soul-searching journeys, and I was having a nice, quiet moment when I came across a small, metallic object jutting up from the sand. Intrigued, I wiggled and pulled at it until it loosened and slipped out of the ground. It was a voice recorder, the thin, silvery kind used by morticians examining dissected bodies. I turned it over and was surprised to find it was still in one piece. It even had a tape inside. I must admit, I was a little excited. I mean, I'd never found buried treasure before. I headed back to the hostel, wondering where it might have come from. Was it dropped off the side of a tourist boat accidentally? Or maybe it was the modern-day message in a bottle with a desperate plea for rescue from a desert island? When I made it back to the hostel, I locked myself in one of the available study rooms and replaced the rusted batteries with fresh ones. I pressed the rewind button and waited as the tape spun backwards in time, eventually coming to a jolting halt. Then I pressed play. Captain's Log, September 29, 2015, 2100 hours. This is Captain, redacted, of the SS Redacted. To call today trying would be a bit of an understatement. We haven't even set sail, so to speak, and already the crew is at each other's throats. Someone cheated at cards the other night, and the bad blood hasn't died down. I broke up several pushing matches. My damn throat's raw from having to yell at these idiots all day. I need a lozenge and some sleep. Tomorrow we depart. Meteorologists are telling me that we will be sailing straight into a tropical storm, with high chances of it becoming a hurricane. I've changed the route slightly, but it shouldn't be too bad. 3 meters waves are nothing we can't handle. Hopefully the rest of the crew can all act like adults once the job starts. Signing off. Static then. Captain's Log, September 30th, 2015, 1700 hours. This is Captain of the SS. Today has been strange. This morning we departed. Things were fine. Uneasy stares between some of the crew, but everybody pulled their weight. Around 1400 hours, however, one of the crew members caught sight of a small passenger boat floating dead in the water. We hailed them on the radio, but there was no response. So we sent out a few to recon, and what we found was unsettling. The ship looked fine, no outward damage, though there was an awful lot of water on the deck. Not uncommon, but strange, given the lack of activity. We searched the craft briefly and found Hiding below deck in a cabinet, a small emaciated boy, wearing only torn shorts and a little necklace with bird shapes tied to it. When we tried to retrieve him, he screamed at us to leave him, said that he was cursed, that the ship was cursed, and that we would be cursed, too. Poor kid, was starved and dehydrated. Delusions like this aren't uncommon when you've been stranded. We brought him kicking and screaming on board the Redacted, and I tried to ask him his name and how long he'd been there and where his parents were, but he just stared back at me. His eyes, ringed and bloodshot, looked like they'd seen as much as the oldest sailor amongst us. "You're all going to die," he whispered, a lone tear sliding down his sunken cheek. "Why do you say that?" I asked, indulging in his fantasy. "Because I shot it." "Shot what?" "The albatross," he said. "And now they won't leave." "They?" "My dad and my uncle and all the others without eyes." I felt shivers seize up the back of my neck. The kid really believed what he was saying. I took him below decks and gave him a bunk. Outside, the storm was kicking up, but the Redacted had weathered storms much worse than this. I wasn't worried, and I'm still not worried. I'll hail the Coast Guard in the morning and see about getting someone to fly out here and pick up the kid. Maybe figure out what happened to the rest of his group. Signing off. Static, then. Captain's log, September 30th, 2015. This is Captain of the SS. It's currently 0100 hours, and things have been happening. The weather outside has worsened considerably, and I'm beginning to doubt the safety of our course. On top of that, several fights have broken out since we brought the boy on board, most of them over cards, but a few over what a few of the crew claimed to have seen in the water. I don't know who told them what the boy had said to me, but three of the crew claimed to have seen bodies in the water swimming around the ship. Impossible. I know. Nobody can swim 25 knots, let alone get within a few meters of the ship and not get dragged under. Even dolphins give us a pretty wide berth when we're moving at this speed. Regardless, this has made a few of the crew uneasy. I guess oceanic superstitions really do die hard. It wouldn't have been so hard to calm them down, except there was something else adding fuel to their terror. Something was knocking on the ship's hull. Something loud, something heavy. I told the boys that it was just the anchor coming a bit loose in the rough seas, but they all saw through that lie quickly. We searched inside and out for the source of the knocking, but there was nothing. For now, I've chalked it up to faulty repairs. Probably a loose metal sheet somewhere in the bilge. Not a good thing to have heading into a storm at the rate we were, but not the worst thing either. Signing off. Static, then. Captain's log, October 1st, 2015, 0700 hours. This is Captain Redacted of the SS Redacted. We're in trouble. The tropical storm has picked up. Instruments are telling me it's now a Category 3 hurricane. If everything goes well, we'll only lose the shipping containers strapped to the deck. They can be retrieved later. To make matters worse, the crew responsible for sighting the bodies in the water last night have disappeared. Jonathan, Martin, and Reggie are all missing. All lifeboats are accounted for. All bunks have been checked. John was in charge during their watch. He's normally the level-headed, responsible one. I have a hard time believing they all fell overboard, and if we'd been attacked in the night, I wouldn't be standing here in my quarters talking into a small fucking box. I'd probably be on deck with a gun pointed at my head. So where the fuck have they gone? Our searches will continue for as long as they can, but we're sailing into a hurricane, and soon we'll need all hands on deck to hold the ship together. Their fates will have to wait until we've weathered a storm. The boy, however, seems to know exactly where they are. The entire morning, he's been screaming from his cabin that they were taken. I tried to question him further, but he was reduced to inconsolable sobbing, and I don't have time to make him feel better. Not when the ship is going to be ripped apart. That banging on the hull still hasn't gone away. To say it's beginning to get on my nerves would be a bit of a fucking understatement. Anyway, we're passing coordinates, and right now, which isn't helping with the blooming superstitions among the crew, All we need to do is weather the storm. That's all we need to do. Just weather the storm. Signing off. Static then. Captain's log, October 1st, 2015. I don't know the time. I've locked myself in my cabin and barricaded the door. Something's happened to the crew, and almost to me. The storm has become a monster. I'm not sure we'll survive, and my crew, well, we found Jonathan, Martin, and Reggie. Or rather, they found us. We were on the bridge monitoring the storm, and we saw three shapes climb over the edge of the ship and onto the deck. I ran out to them with lifelines in case a rogue wave hit, but stopped. When I got close enough to see them in the storm's dim light, their eyes were gone, and from their sockets hung strands of seaweed, like dark tears made of the sea, swaying in the ocean's raging winds. Seawater poured onto the deck from their slacks, and from the sleeves of their shirts, and small crabs and other chitinous sea life fell and skittered over their sodden shoes. Then dead men moved like they were alive, like they knew exactly what they were doing. John lunged for me. The seaweed sprang across his face, his yellow teeth stained with black sands of the ocean floor. But before he could get a hold, a wave crashed between us, vaulting me away down the deck in a rush of seawater. The slack in my line gave way, and the wave receded, leaving me gasping for air against the chilled steel of the deck. When I looked up, John and the others were rushing the bridge, unimpeded by the rush of the waves. I unhooked my line and sprinted for the trapdoor below deck. From the control bridge, I heard screams echo over the rage of the storm, saw the windows crack as bodies collided with the thick glass from within. The boy knew this was going to happen. The boy fucking knew. I raced below deck, straight for the boy's cabin. But when I arrived, I found the boy hanging from the ceiling grate, his bird necklace digging into his blue throat. The words, "I'm sorry," were scratched into the floor beneath his dangling feet. I closed his door and headed straight for my cabin. And now, here I sit, maps of my beloved ocean spread out before me. Outside my door, I can hear them pulling and kicking, trying to get in. Oh, look at that. Seawater is beginning to seep in, and something is still banging against the ship's hull, banging and smashing in step with the pound of my dead crew's hands on my cabin door. Slow, relentless, unstopping, like destruction's own heartbeat. God's name, have mercy. In God's name, please, have mercy. The tape ended in a hiss of static as I sat there in the study, staring at the small recorder. The next day, I took it to the local Coast Guard station and left my contact information in case they needed anything from me. A little while later, they called me, told me not to talk to anyone about what I'd heard. That was a bad idea, because now I can't stop thinking about it, about the horror in the captain's voice, about the images of his eyeless crew, and about the knocking on the hull, which was loud enough to be heard on his logs. The knocking that follows me through my day, a hollow, godless sound, a sound I hear as I drive further up this coast, that I hear as the weather ahead now grows darker and darker.